Session number 16715, John Jarvis, Reel 5.
Mr. Jarvis, Reel 5. When you left Durban, Mr. Jarvis, did you take on any extra troops in Durban itself?
Not that I know of, no. What a lovely 10 days there, a week there, was it a week? And no, we just got back on the boat and off we went. Up. Like, it was a holiday, you know, we went up through the Straits of like Madagascar, right way up, you know, lovely hot weather. And I love the, you know, I used to love to get on deck and sunbathe. And our boat had a swimming pool, which they converted sometimes to a boxing ring. The lads had bits of boxing matches, you know. It was always something to occupy the mind, because that was the whole fault about it, you know. You were bored to tears, you know. It's lovely for the first day or two, just lounging on the decks, you know, and getting the sun, and lovely after the climate we used to, but we got up there and we got to what they call it, the other end of the, is it Port Twofrig, is it? Port Twofrig, we landed in Port Twofrig.
What date would this be?
About June, was it about June 41? About June 41, yeah.
And what was your first impressions of Egypt?
Sand. And first time I saw the Suez Canal, I was very impressed. I thought it was the River Gondless, the River Weir, you know. I thought, well, I was able to get boats down. These big boats down. It was just like I just couldn't gaze at it. I was, you know, I read about it when I was at school, and you know, but to see it, it was really, I was fascinated by it, I tell you the truth. It seems they clean it out pretty regular, you know, and they dredge it pretty regular. And it did its job. It was a marvellous thing, I thought. And up the side of there, the Suez, was a camp called Ismailia, which the IBD, the Infantry Base Depot. I think that's where I was in hospital like a couple of weeks with this, what they call it now, enteritis. And it's something I thought was similar to malaria, you know. And I was the first man, more or less, to get it, you know, and I was there was girls, British girls in the IBD, you know, and that was lovely to talk to some of the illnesses, you know, it was smashing.
Was there a lot of illness in the battalion when they first arrived for the first
No, I think we took it very well. We went through a period of time where, you know, getting used to the weather and the conditions, and we all seemed to expect odd man over ginger, you know. Yeah, you really get blebs and sunburn and
fair skinned men.
Ginger worst. If you're ginger, you know, you get no fair skinned men. I was fair skinned, blonde hair, but I never blebs. I used to tan. In fact, when you took off to get showered, you just a little bit of white strip around. That was it. You were brown as a body. It was fascinating after. But of course, at first, you know, to get climatized, you don't do no parades, you say, from 11 to 3 or 12 to 3. You get 2 or 3 hours off at dinner time in the heat of the sun. And you're supposed to lie on your bivouac and then come back and on the afternoon and start and live again, sort of style. Well, as we got used to it, that was it. We'd never used to go on the bivouac at dinner time. We used to, you know, we got used to the heat, I think it. A period of somewhat 10 weeks or 12 weeks, climatisation, more or less, you know, bits of breaks in there.
What were you doing there when you first...
Excuse me, at first we had nothing to do. Then as we got acclimatised, we started doing ordinary English training. That's one thing about the British Army. I don't know if they were held at a certain... Your arms doing that, you know. I suppose they do it when they're needing, and needing's red hot. But that's, once you get acclimatized, we start doing our normal training, you know. every morning we'd have half an hour on there. But why, to make it interesting, we also have into the town things, you know, where we could set the gun with pastors and get the first, you know, in so many seconds. And if you could knock a second off the record, why, that was a good deed for the day, so to start. Because with us being in the motor platoon, we didn't do a great deal of rifle training, you know. We knew the basics of the rifle and the blend gun and all that. And we'd fight our course before we left England, and we now specialise in the 3-inch motor. And that's what we did to pass the time. We played with the motor until we could bang it up in the crack, you know. They reckon the real idea of training is that, so when you're in action, your actions become automatic. You can put the gun up even if you're blindfolded. It's the same with a blend gun. They used to train us by liners on the floor with a blend gun all in pieces, and we used to have to assemble it blindfolded. And it's marvellous how adapted you can do it after, you know, a few times, after a few weeks. You would come in handy, I say, in the dark or something like that, and then you've got to misfire, and you have a certain procedure to go through to get the bullet out, you know. It was good training, that I thought.
Had the 3-inch mortar any problems, you know, weaknesses? Was it really
reliable? Right. I found out later the point about the 3-inch mortar was the base plate. You know, you had to set it down like that. Actually, when you fired the first bomb, it flattened it out. Your base plate was down like that. And your barrel was in the base plate. You fired the first bomb, that base plate, you see. Now, depending on the conditions where you had the base plate. And later on, I'll tell you about it. I fired it in Italy, and I'll tell you about it later on. But that was the only fault I had. Apart from that, it was a good weapon to use. I thought it was very good. But it was short of the range, and it should have had to compete. If it's like taking a rifle against a tank, and taking a 3-inch mortar against a German mortar, and he has 200-300 yards more range than you. You know, so he's making you come out in the open to follow him, you know, and he's a disadvantage all the time.
It was a question of what the ground was like for putting your base plate on.
I found that out after, you know, because when you fired the first shot, your base plate, you see, so
the recoil.
That's right. It used to be terrific, you know. It was a 10-pound bomb, and you see, woof, and it could turn it round a bit, say, and that could upset all your calculations. So it was very important how you laid your base plate, so that when you did fire the first bomb, it rested properly, you know, in the ground, you know. And of course, you get different terrain, you know. You can go to Italy in the mountainside, and it's perfect terrain because you have about 6 inches of soil and rock. And once it got in the soil, it was, you know, steady. But in the desert, the sand and that, it was a different kettle of fish, you know.
What was the ideal terrain or ground to set up a mortar? What did you look for if you're going to set up a mortar?
Well, English conditions was as good as anything, you know. European conditions, where you can get foot of soil, because if you put on firm English soil, it would just recoil back level, and you could fire 10-20 bombs after that and wouldn't move, you know what I mean? It would just bed itself in, and well, if you cut a bit with a bit rock or a bit sir, it would turn over, you know, if you hadn't firm ground. But I would say European conditions were perfect for mortar.
Did you look for ground for setting up, say, with a rising ground in front of you?
It was best because, you see, you had to have a rangefinder, a proper rangefinder apparatus, and he used to get in front on the rise, you see, and he used to give you the range back. Now, as you were groping, it showed back when you first bump down 50, you know, then next down, 25, fire on target. Then when you thought you were on the target, right, fired at wheels. And you just fired on his say. He was the man. Say, I was number one. I was Alan's corporal. I fed the bombs and did the sight, you know. And the men were stretched out here with the bomb cases there. And they handed them along and I out of the sight, put the bomb in. And but told us the sight was the most important part of the plane smart there. Well, I found out later on, by training and looking at it properly, I could manipulate without the sights. You see, a quarter turn was, say, 20 yards, or half a turn was 50 yards, or a full turn was 100 yards, whichever day I use. Unless you're a bad rangefinder, you know. But once you've got 50 yards, if you could, in a crack, without lining up that, in a crack, touch it like that and fire before you got the sights lined up. And it would work, you know.
Did you move amongst the companies of the battalion? You weren't kind of...
Well, later we were attached, we got attached to the carrier, Brengon carrier. And we were set up behind the Brengon carrier, you know, as a bit of jail and that.
But your role was basically to move wherever you were needed.
Well, that's right. But you say the whole point about you needed a man to carry the base plate, which was heavy, you know, base plate heavy. The barrel, about a good metre long, barrel, you know, maybe 4 foot. One man carry that. Now the tripod, which was a big steel tripod like that, with a supper done like that, he'd had to be carried. See? Then I carried the fourth man, he carried the sights, and, you know, and observation man carried his rangefinder. But the three men that was carrying the mortar, if they had any distance to travel, they were very cumbersome. Now, if you were set up behind the Brengon carrier and you fired 4 or 5 rounds, you could bang it in the bend, in the carrier. As long as you had the sights in the bag, nothing would take hurt. Just bang the carrier, jump in the way. Which you were sharper altogether and trying to put on your button to carry it, you know. Oh. I thought it was a good idea, you know. It was a bit sheltered and it was means for getting you from here to B.
How did you carry your bombs for it?
In a truck, what about 1500 weight truck with just been cases, so many in a case. Of course, you could take them out and put them in a trench if you're going to be in a static position for a while, you know. But majority of the time, you just had so many in the rest was dug in the whole side of the hill, you know. In the desert, you were always digging, you know. They wanted two or three battalions to do the miners that if they keep digging the moles and put the wagons in and the guns in and the, you know.
Who was in command of you? Who was commanding the mortars?
Kirby. He was a lieutenant at the time, second lieutenant.
He hadn't changed from England.
Oh, he's with us all the time.
Can we go back to the camp? Was it a good camp that you were in when you first arrived in Egypt?
Oh, I said, yeah, you know, it was. I remember one night when we were invited out with it, to the Gurkha place, you know, and this little fella, the light little pit lads, the Gurkha, you know, about 4 foot blank and little top and scut, you know. And we sort of took to them because they're such good lads, you know, such great lads, and they're a very, very high opinion of the British Army. So the regular days, you know, and I'm afraid we blocked so copies over 3 times, but they had a very high regard for the British Army. I remember being in the canteen once, and one of them said to me, he says, you want cigarettes? And I said, oh, yeah, please. And he went in for cigarettes, and I'll never forget the name, they call him Pedros. I made them about 5 for a penny. And I just got one draw of it, I wanted no more, that it nearly lifted me head off. I said, that's the finish of them, I'll give over smoking now. Aye, they were very strong, you know. Of course, the art of the country you're in, the stronger the tobacco, I suppose.
What facilities did the camp have?
Well, there was the canteen and cinema, and the base depot, oh, there was everything, just the same as being at home. You know, there was a big hospital, a big training depot, there was all sorts, you know. There was a canteen, big canteen, and that's where you could get beer and things like that, you know, and things that pineapple chunks, which had juice in, you know, used to be a lot of juice in, and pears, and things like that.
Where did you go to next? Well, you weren't in Egypt very long.
No. Went up there then, Masjid Alexandria. That's where we sailed from, Alexandria to Cyprus.
Do you remember the journey?
Oh, hell, I was fascinated. Oh, it was great. It was, it's hard to explain. Like, I mean, we come from a little village and we'd never been and never seen, I think. Then all of a sudden, all these experiences were thrust upon us, you know. And to me, going from Alexandria to Cyprus, I'd never been on a boat like that before. It was terrific, you see. It had been an ex-British naval boat, you know, and it turned it over to the New Zealand lads, and they... I remember one big lad, you know, this big New Zealand lad, he says to me, "Hey," he says, "have you got a knife, fork and spoon?" I thought, "Hello, I'm going to get myself a feeder," you know. Because 21, you can only say something, you know. "Yes," I says, "I've got something good in your mind." "No," he says, "the last bloody lot went on here," he says, "the pinched all I was." Off he went, I thought, "Well, yes, I've been that again." Yeah, we went over, I think it was Famagusta where we went over. And I tell you, it was like a fairy story. What a beautiful place Cyprus was, and you went there, unspoiled. I know that the Greeks and the Turks had a little bit of trouble, but it was unspoiled, it was beautiful. So we went like, and some of the lads used to go out in the nick of say, any road that finished it. To cut the long story short, they put it out of bounds, nick of say. You know, the military police and the
thing. Why was that?
Well, I think the lads, you know, they'd never seen these type of places. You get in a place like that, and there's... I mean, in England, we have no brothers. Well, them places, just a way of life. It's nothing, you know. You go in the cabaret bar, big chandeliers, and right across the front of this big bar, you know, big, very big place, dancing, you know, nearly all the time. There's this farm full of girls, you know, and I mean girls, very... really good-looking girls. Why, the lads, you know, they used to buy for a dollar, we used to give them, for a dollar, you could get these 10 tickets and dance with the girls and buy them a drink and other things and all, you know what I mean? And the lads, it was nearly all cognac. You know, these wine-producing countries, it's cognac, brandy. And we went ready for cognac, you know, and we used to go out and... The lads, I know my mate, he got a real turn off, he conked out with it. And he said to me, "Go on, you'll get it, it's all right, just like lemonade." And I said, "No, I don't like spirits." I said, "I'll stick to what I've got, you know. I was drinking like mineral water, and, you know." Well, I walked out and I was walking along the main road, and when I turned down, he was laid flat on the back of the car. So we took him back to the camp and said, "Well, get a good night's sleep, we'll be all right tomorrow." But next day, he didn't wake up, and I was shaking him. "Go and get him a pot of tea," and I got him a pot of tea and he was out again. Anyhow, long story short, he couldn't turn out for praying. He got hammered a little bit because he was drunk on active duty. Well, that sort of learned us a lesson. Like, he paid the price for it.
What were you doing in Cyprus?
We were making airfields in that. Was it Cyprus or Iraq? The one she showed us a little pamphlet, how to use a picking shovel. That's honest truth. You know, that is the honest truth. And I looked at my mate and I said, "Where the hell do you think we come from? America?" I said, "You know, Durham lads, how to use a picking shovel. You know. They did expect this invasion from Crete, you know. And when we went to Cyprus, it was just an island. It was just a beautiful... got in the Mediterranean, beautiful little island, and the fruit. We went when it was all the grapes and everything just coming, you know. I saw everything but a coconut. I never saw no coconuts. Everywhere I went, I looked for coconuts and never seen any yet. It was beautiful, beautiful. And we went to a place called Kyrene, and I was doing driving lessons there. They asked for volunteers to do like a course of driver maintenance. Well, yes, I took this diving course, but I didn't take the maintenance bit. I had no interest in it. And I think I was a bit of a fool, like, because it was something to break the monotony, you know. And you never know when it comes in handy. And but at 21 and 22-year-old, you have got no, have you? You've got no realization of what's to come. You don't think about the future, you just think about the day, say. And I took the driving test. And it isn't the best place in the world to take a diving test. Still, Cyprus is all hills and beautiful scenery, but it's a bad place for roads and that. And once or twice I had a couple of near squeaks, but you see, what used to happen is you put so many lads in the back, and you went and you did half an hour's driving with the instructor, then you got in the back, and then another one on the front. Well, it was a lazy man, we have a day out, you know what I mean? And just go back and get your dinner, then out on the afternoon again, you know. And it was all right, it was something to pass the time. When you got to see the island a little bit, you know, because it is really a beautiful place. We used to go up to a place called Kyrenia. There was a bit of a camp there for displaced persons. There were a couple of 3 days on there, maybe he's on guard or something like that, which they weren't a guard, they had nowhere to go, the poor people. I believe there were some Italians and some maybe, you know, different nationalities that were displaced persons. And they were like wired off like with a bit down part of the sea where they used to swim every day and lie about in the sun. And there may be people that had ice cream parlours and things like that in places like Limassol and Famagusta and maybe Nicosia itself, because there was a lot of Greek people there and Turks. Now they reckon from on a clear day that you can see the Turkish coast from Cyprus. I never tried it because it seemed a pretty long way away, but they reckon you could see it. My mate said you could see it, and that's good enough for me. But when we were there, there wasn't the trouble that they've had since. Although it was like a hotbed, but they were still living together, and that, as long as people are living together, there's a big chance of me pulling out of it. And Nicosia was a lovely town. The sun tells me now it's all parted and done away with, like. But we had a lovely time there. We made these bits of airfields, and it was gorgeous. The fruit, there was that much fruit you could see.
were the Cypriots involved in helping you deal with it?
No. That's where I first came across this expression wogs, you know. We call them wogs. Anybody with a bit colouring, they would call them wogs. That was it. It's not a terrible thing, but that's what happened, you know. the Italians called them wogs.
Were they friendly towards you, the Cypriots?
Why, they traded with us, you know. It was a source of income to them, I expect, because... Because there were a lot of soldiers there, there was a lot of money to spend. And when we went there, the things was that cheap. It was unbelievable, you know. You could get a much fruit to fill that corner for a shilling, you know. Even the girls and that, when you went out with them, they used to cost you nothing, you know. And I had some photos taken with a little Greek father at the photographic shop, you know, where they took the photos and that. And she says, can I come on the photograph? I said, of course, because one or two of them spoke pidgin English, you know. And where the photo was taken with a little girl, and I christened him Ovita, because that's the only name on your right. You know, and everybody could start calling him Ovita. And we used to go there and, you know, and they were very nice people, like it. They were Greek. But they had this inborn... no trust with the Turks, it's a mountain. You could say it was boiling, you know, the little fraternities of Greeks and the place of Turks. And, well, it did happen, didn't it? I mean, it all burst up after that, like, but when we were there, they were living together. And I enjoyed that was a beautiful holiday, that's for me. I thought it was a smashing.
What conditions were you sleeping and living in?
Oh, we'd be back out. When you get climates like that, you know, your biggest sky is scorpions and things like that. Which, I mean, they get in your kid bug, they get all over. But we were given talks about scorpions, and they told us there was two different types. There's one would make you, well, bit you'd make it swell, but there's another one which they call it, I believe, was a black scorpion. They're pretty deadly if they eat. You had to get in the hospital and get an antidote of some description, I don't know. I never see the one. I've seen many of the others. My mate got bitten just off the iron. He had a lovely, really big black eye, you know. They were terrible things. They got all over in your kid bag, and I'm putting you on your kid bag to get some of it out of you. You're in a bit of trouble, like they sting you. But most of them was, you know, they just caused a swelling. They didn't really, like, it was best to go over and get something put on them, you know what I mean? But they didn't kill you, nothing like that. There was maybe the odd snake or so, you know, but... on the whole, we were just off a grape. The grapes were just put up in the tent and you couldn't get bugs, but you get sick of them. You know, it's like everything else. It's you get sick. At first, we used to eat them. Couldn't eat our dinners for eating grapes. And tangerines, you know, lovely things, tangerines. Lovely.
How big was a bivouac? How many people could it hold?
See, what happens is there's two of you, put your ground sheets together, the walls, put them together like that, and there's barely room to get in, you know, and put your kit in that. And but it's you know, when you're in a country like that, as I said before, it's
are you just lying on the earth?
Unless you had a spare ground sheet or something like that, you know. Yeah. But it's not damp like it is in this country, you know what I mean? If you're laying on the ground in this country, you'll get low and maybe no morning time to wake. But I mean, the climate's that different. It's just normal 110, 115, you know. Well, you don't want no clothes on at that. It got a little bit cold at night time, but through the day, you'd like to test the blade and let off. It really hot, you know. Of course, by then we were acclimatized to the heat, and we used to wear soak it up, you know.
Were you, as a mortar man, involved in the digging?
Yes. We did our infantry charges as well, yes. We're part of the infantry, you say. Oh, yes. But we had quite a company specialised in different types of armour, like, you know. The infantry just had the rifle, you know, maybe the Ben Gun. Well, the headquarter company had the Ben Gun carriers, the mortars, and this and that, that's a specialised company, but it's still part of the battalion. We still had rifles, Tommy guns, the same as them.
When you finished your digging, did you do any manoeuvres, exercises on the island?
Not that I can remember, no. I think the scare died down pretty sharp. Because in reality, when I look at the history books, he was pretty lucky to get all the crate, you know, and I think he'd done his dinger to get that, you know, and that was the finish. He didn't come, and we knew he wasn't going to come, and we just enjoyed the island. If he had come, we prepared for him, best way we could. Because if he'd come, it would have been paratroops, wouldn't it? It would have been, he wouldn't have come by sails, he wouldn't get halfway, it would have been paratroops. He wouldn't have gotten Cyprus as easy when he got trade, I put it that way, you know.
Living in your bivouacs, were you in bivouacs all the time that you were there?
You didn't
move on to anything else?
Well, no barracks, no. No barracks.
What was the food like that you were getting from the army?
Well, I've said this before. Such as I was born and brought up in Durham, we used to all sell, you know, food. We're not used to fancy food. And the food was all right, you know. You didn't get as much meat as, because it in our countries, you know, you've got to be careful, very careful with the meat. See, and then and once we got a little sheet of paper, like a battalion or a division newspaper, you know, and that were away at the camera, you know. Slip the camera in somewhere there. I think we got that camera. Everybody else here, we got that camera. It was the meat. You used to have to put strong curries and things like that. You know, but as far as food goes, I mean, you could go 10 yards and get as many tomatoes as a single battleship. And tomatoes in summer with a bit of lettuce and a bit of salt and, you know.
How did you keep yourselves clean?
I wasn't swimming a lot. Every chance I got, I was in the mud. It's beautiful. Well, I mean, everybody wasn't as lucky, maybe, as I was, but the infantry companies, they maybe dug in somewhere, I don't know. But we got to the seaside pretty regular, you know. I tell you, I was doing this driving trip, and every chance we got, we were in the water 5 or 10 minutes, and it was brilliant. Kyrene was brilliant. Oh, we always had the old donkey going around down the water, you know. It was one of them type of islands where the donkey runs around the ring and pulls the water up, so he gets there. Oh, old-fashioned, beautiful old island. They told us, I don't know if this was true, but they told us that the Durhams were the first British soldiers ever to go to Cyprus. And that's what they told us. I don't know if it's true. That's what they said. The Durhams were the first British troops to go in Cyprus. You know, that's... Arthur Cypress was a lovely episode in my army life. It was a smashing place, and I enjoyed every bit of it, you know. I thought it was smashing.
You mentioned Nicosia and ultimately going out of bounds.
Yes.
How did it become boring in any way? Were you looking for leisure of any
kind? Well, we still used to go in places like Limassol, and you know, which is a lovely place to know. I think the reason what had happened somewhere, when we stand in tow, you carry your arms, it doesn't matter where you go, you're supposed to take the toilet with you, you know, in case you go straight out of action. Well, you see, as I've told you before, when we went abroad, we had quite a few Scotch lads. And the boisterous type of lads, you know, they mix in with the Durhams. Of course, the Durhams are boisterous lads. No, they're like a bit fun, they're drinking. And you can imagine about 400 sitting in this big dance hall with big chandeliers, and that somebody would get up and I never shot at the chandeliers, you know. And next thing you know, all the place would be surrounded with red caps.